This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Now, on Philadelphia's Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, a closer look.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martirano. We hope you found out about Recovery Radio. We've been doing this a long time now. What we do is talk about behavioral health. That's a big, broad term. It means lots of things. Central to the notion of behavioral health is obviously substance abuse, something we've always talked about on Recovery Radio, but now we're covering a broader spectrum of also mental health issues. And as you know, if you know anything at all about substance abuse and mental health, they are very often intimately linked together. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat Behavioral Health, about which more a little bit later. It's in that area of mental health and behavioral health in general that we're going to focus today. And I guess if I had to come up with a short thumbnail description of the program today, it would be that expression that we've all heard endlessly. These kids today, there's probably not been a generation quite like the millennials for being examined and often savagely criticized and satirized. It's tough to be a kid, I believe, at any time in life. It's a very demanding job being a young adolescent, and it's not getting any easier. We're going to take a look at a sort of very broad look at the condition of young people and their mental health. It's been estimated by people who keep track of this thing that as many as one in five adolescents has some sort of diagnosable mental health disorders. Now, these things can range from garden variety depression or even deeper depression, anxiety. There's a whole autism spectrum disorder problems there, to personality and behavioral disorders. So we're going to take a look at that, sort of the state of young people today. And to that end, we reach out again to our great resource, and that is Retreat Behavioral Health, in the person of Liza Piekarski. Liza Piekarski. Liza is a licensed medical health counselor. She's a certified addictions professional and a qualified supervisor. She works in the state of Florida. Liza has extensive background in working with adolescents and young adults who are struggling with these issues, both substance abuse and mental health concerns in both residential and outpatient settings. And I could go on and on. I'll let her talk a little bit more about her background straight ahead. So we want to welcome Liza to the program. Hi, Liza. Thanks for joining us on Recovery Radio.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me today.
So before we get into the weeds on this thing, tell us a little about your background. You know, where are you from? Where did you go to school? And most importantly, what attracted you to this field?
Sure. So I grew up in Cliffside Park, New Jersey, a very small town right outside of New York City. And I came down to Florida to pursue my career or to pursue my college career at Nova Southeastern University, where I actually came in as an undecided major. Buddy, my parents gave me an option, go to college and get out of New Jersey. So at the time, I really had to take a look and see what I wanted to do, since I was not able to stay in the state of New Jersey anymore due to some situations that I was getting involved in as an adolescent. So I pursued my bachelor's degree at Nova Southeastern University as an undecided major. And really the point that shifted me towards making my decision and where I was going to go in terms of declaring my major was my adolescent psychology class that I took maybe my junior year in college. So I went undecided the whole time, enjoying kind of riding that wave. And I started getting involved in the psychology classes, mental health piece, and I took a class in adolescent psychology. And the one thing that I always say sticks with me is I had a professor, and at the time we were learning about the John Locke theory of tabula rasa, which means a blank slate. Mm-hmm. And so I had taken several classes at the time, but this stuck out with me, tabula rasa, blank slate, meaning, you know, these adolescents, these teenagers were coming in, these kids with really a clean slate and a chance to do something different. So that's where my passion started. of wanting to work with adolescents, feeling like I had the opportunity to give them hope and work with them on creating a lifestyle that was more productive in mm-hmm. society.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. You say you had your share of adolescent difficulties. We don't have to go into that if you don't want to. But as you were open to this field, as you say, through your professors and your courses, did you see in, for instance, adolescent psychology, behaviors that reflected your experience as a young person?
Absolutely, yes.
And that was one of the major contributors to getting you involved in this thing, right?
Yes, it's just it really goes back to understanding adolescence and having access to services mm-hmm. and knowing the adolescent mind and brain functioning and the development of it. And that was really what was interesting to me, is why teenagers and adolescents do what they do. So that's really what sparked my interest.
Anybody who's ever spent
adolescence.
Anyone who's ever spent any time around young people will tell you that they, I don't know how to say this and be charitable, they're not like us. They are almost like they're from another planet. And you couldn't be more correct in that. You have to approach this understanding that you're talking about a unique subset of people, and these are young people, and the slate can very, very often be not only clear, as you said, but you can write a lot of bad stuff on it. It is a very stressful period. Having said that, I mentioned at the beginning that figures I've seen say upwards of 1 in 5 have some sort of mental health disorder. Is that your experience? That's a shocking number. Is the problem that widespread?
I would say it is. And I think that there's a spectrum. And, of course, we utilize the DSM to make those diagnoses. And not everybody is going to fall under that category. What I think is more important to focus on is the symptoms. We might not meet full criteria for a diagnosis. But in terms of mental health, having certain symptoms, whether it's, moments of sadness, whether it's situational, doesn't necessarily have to be categorized into a major depression disorder, or having some anxiety doesn't necessarily have to mean a diagnosis of generalized anxiety, but we all experience. So whether it's 1 in 5 that are actually diagnosed, I think it's what's really important to recognize is that we all experience some form in our life, probably on a daily basis, of some symptoms that could be categorized in the DSM without meeting full criteria for diagnosis of a mental health.
And the reason, let me see if I'm right here, and the reason that's particularly important among adolescents is that unlike an adult who has been manifesting this behavior and suffering from it for a very long time, the sooner we identify these behaviors, I suppose a professional like you's job is to make sure it doesn't become a full-blown diagnosable disorder. I mean, if you get there early, you can have some effect, correct?
Absolutely. Early intervention is proven to be the most effective component be able to get in. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. You've been doing this for how long now, dealing with adolescents and young adults?
I want to say since 2004, I started working with children on the spectrum, is where I actually started my first piece, where I did applied behavior analysis for children on the spectrum.
So you've got 15 years in the field here. In your experience and from what you've seen, is this problem of mental health disorder growing among adolescents and young adults, do you think?
I would say so, yes.
I want you to be general here because we're going to take a break real soon. But what are some of the factors that you've seen that contribute to this? I mean, this is sort of the golden age of disorders in general, but this is really troubling. Every day we read another article about depression, and among people younger and younger, they're seeing this going on. In your view, what are some of the broad general factors that may be contributing to this spread of disorders among young people?
I'll give you a few without going into too much detail, but of course, social media, just instant gratification, access. The more we've become connected as a society with phones and internet, the more disconnected we have become in that personal connection, that personal communication. So that's another piece. And also understanding long-term consequences would be another one. And then the stigma that we have around mental health diagnoses.
I have a theory that, social media is everybody's boogeyman. Sometimes the critique is overdone, but not very often in my view, particularly among young people. And my theory has been that growing up before smartphones and the internet, you could take a break from being a kid competing with your peers. You'd go home. You get out of your school clothes, you'd be just a schlub around the house making your parents crazy, but you weren't in this constant spotlight of competition. That's gone for kids today. There's no relaxing, is there?
No, exactly what you said. I was just having this discussion with someone else, and you got to go home. You got to take some time out to disconnect, to take that 24-hour rule. That doesn't happen anymore. You're constantly being connected. You're being reminded, and everybody's posting. All posts are glorified. As adults, we can recognize that, okay, that might be a picture, but underneath we don't see it all. Because kids' brains are not fully developed, they don't see it like we do. So they're not able to differentiate between that. So I think that's another factor.
And it's a full-time job being young and trying to fit in, correct?
Absolutely.
Lisa Pikarski is our guest. Lisa is a licensed mental health counselor. Incidentally, I sort of buried the lead, as they say in newspapers. Lisa, in her role as a counselor, has had some intimate experience with the violence that we know is a far too common thing now in our schools. I'm thinking specifically of some grief counseling work that Liza did in the wake of the Parkland shooting in Florida. We will find out about all of that later on in our interview with her. This is Recovery Radio. If you have young people in your life, whether they're troubled or just your garden variety pain in the neck kids, listen up. There's a lot of information here that I think is going to be very valuable. This is Recovery Radio. We'll be back. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano is who I am, and you'll notice I never get my name wrong. I wish I could say that much about my guests very often. I want to apologize to Liza Pikarski, who is my guest on the telephone. I've been calling her Lisa. It's Liza. Liza's a licensed mental health counselor, and she's talking to us about the group of people she has spent 15 years or so treating for both substance disorders and mental health issues in general, and that's adolescents and young adults. Liza, let's talk about some of the social media problems that exist. I guess it's Instagram now that's driving this whole thing, and we know, even if we're not on Instagram, from what we see and hear and read, that there's a whole group of young people, both guys and girls, who are what are referred to as influencers. They're on that platform, Instagram, to try to convince other people that the things they're doing, the clothes they're wearing, the food they're eating, the schools they got into are exactly what everybody else should be doing. And these things have an amazing a very, very influential effect on young people. In your view, are they a net negative or net neutral, or how dangerous is this whole atmosphere?
It could potentially be dangerous, but I don't think that's necessarily their intention. There's a wide variety of what we would call Instagram influencers that are getting paid by companies to present in a certain way. So yes, some of them are out there and have positive messages, while others, you know, contribute to some of the issues that we're addressing on this, you know, segment today. So it really just, I think it could go both ways, but at the end of the day, it really goes down to the parents screening and limiting, providing oversight to what is being watched and monitored on, you know, Instagram and Snapchat and whatever other platforms they're utilizing.
Well, let me ask you about that, because when adults look at this, they view it in an adult context. And kids look at it completely differently. When you talk about the role of a parent monitoring that, is that realistic? I mean, how do you? I know you talk to families too when you work with adolescents and young adults. What do you tell them about that? I mean, take the phone away from them? Well, how does that work?
Yeah, so it depends on the severity of what the client's presenting with. Sometimes it is recommended to remove all forms of social media and, you know, cell devices. However, there are right now, believe it or not, there are several apps that you can download as a parent that you can gain access to what your child is looking at. And I know it might seem a little bit like a helicopter parent, and I'm not encouraging parents to just utilize this off the bat, but you want to look for warning signs to see if your child is presenting with certain symptoms, or you start to see declining grades and you can start to assess. But there are apps and ways to monitor screen time, and even starting with limiting the use of phone at night to ensure appropriate sleep so that they can be productive the next day. So it depends. Every family member would be different.
This monitoring of social media, I suppose you would recommend as a rule of thumb for anyone with a young person in their lives, and not just for people who have youngsters with real problems, right? I mean, it's like giving them a tool that they can overdose on them. And, you know, that's an interesting – I wanted to get to that too. Are we seeing anything that really looks like an addiction to this stuff, to social media?
Yes, and that's not just in – I wouldn't even categorize that as adolescents and teenagers. That's going all the way into adulthood.
Are people aware that they're addicted to these things, or do they just think – hey, this is how I keep in touch. I'm not addicted to this, and yet they're on it for hours a day. Do folks recognize they have a connection to this that they can't break?
I don't know if it's always recognized, but it's become a society norm. If you don't have your phone on you, you have your watch that you're connected to. You have your computer. Expectations for having access to for work purposes, or especially, for clients, it really just depends. But I think it's more normalized now, so I'm not sure how often we're recognizing it as a concern.
Right,
because
right.
That's what's accepted.
Yeah, it's so much. Everybody knows the feeling, the anxiety you immediately feel when you find yourself without your phone. And it's unbelievable. I mean, folks who are not sort of strung out on these things, we all share that sense that, oh my goodness, I'm disconnected from something very important. With regard to young people, we've got about a minute and a half here before we have to take another break. Can you give me sort of the common disorders that you see in your practice that young people suffer from?
Yeah, so just I'll give general of what we're seeing overall in the private practice is anxiety, depression, a lot of oppositional defiant disorders, substance abuse, eating disorders more so with females, a lot of parent-child relationship issues.
You know,
so I would say that's probably the bulk of it.
Yeah. What about depression? The things you just described, I don't mean to minimize them, but they sound like your sort of garden variety stresses that we all have because we all live in a crazy plugged in world. Depression is another different kind of phenomenon. We're seeing that a lot among younger and younger people. Correct?
Yes. Yes.
What are they? Oh, we got to take the break. I will take the break now. But when we come back, I want to pick up on, you know, what are they so depressed about? Liza Piekarski is our guest. We have more with Liza straight ahead. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm Steve Martorano. As I said at the beginning here, if you've got young people in your lives, we know how much stress you're under. We hope you're taking the opportunity to listen up to some of this stuff. Our guest has been dealing with young people in substance abuse contexts and mental health issues as well for 15 years now, and she's here to fill us in, Liza Piekarski. We'll be back with Liza in just one second, but I want to remind you, as I do every week, that any questions, comment, any questions at all you have about any topics you hear on this program or in general regarding substance abuse issues or mental health issues, the folks at Retreat want me to give you the phone number, and not because they're going to tell you they're the only place in the world that can help you. They're great. They have a sterling reputation. They're leaders in the field. But they want this phone number to you just for informational purposes. So if you have any questions at all, please feel free to call them at 855-859-8808. That's Retreat Behavioral Health, 855-859-8808. Liza Piekarski works for Retreat. In fact, this week she just celebrated her third anniversary working with Retreat, so congratulations. She specializes in private practice and by training dealing with substance abuse and emotional and mental disorders or problems with young adults and adolescents. And she is with us today, you know, giving us the broad overview of the mental health state of affairs with young people today. It's not good, and it's apparently getting worse. Liza, before the break, we mentioned depression. That's the one of all the common disorders that you mentioned earlier that surprises me the most. We're seeing that younger and younger in kids, aren't we?
Yes. Yes.
What are some of the younger people you've heard about who are suffering from depression? How young does it get?
I mean, it depends. I mean, as far as actual what we would consider depression or the diagnosis of depression, it depends, because we know that in children, depression can manifest itself in aggression. So it's important to monitor that. So while a three-year-old might not be able to, or a five-year-old might not be able to identify feeling depressed or having a specific reason to feel sad or depressed, it might manifest itself in aggressive behaviors. So it really just depends. I mean, when you're talking about the diagnosis and identifying it, it's a little bit older, but we are seeing it younger now.
Let's talk about the screening, and then we'll get into the treatment of these disorders, because all of the things that we've been talking about that you've described that young people are suffering from today can also be looked at from the context of, well, they're just kids, and that's kids get moody, kids get cranky, kids rebel. Talk about, first of all, from a professional standpoint, but also from a practical standpoint, how can parents distinguish between, you know, your garden variety behavior and a potential problem? And then get into the screening that professionals do to make that distinction. What do parents have to do?
Yeah. Just continue to monitor, continue to be aware for changes in behaviors, changes in moods. It's very difficult for a parent. My recommendation would be to bring them to get assessed, talk to the school about any changes in behaviors right away. You want to pay attention to absolutely any changes in behavior at home, in school, in the community.
Well, when you say changes in behavior, can you be a little more specific about that? Because change is part of the process of maturing, correct? I mean, it doesn't automatic when a kid's friends change, for instance. That's always been a red flag. I've heard from professionals, if a change in friends, find out about that. But that might not be a problem. I mean, how does a parent, you know, make that decision that this is a potential problem?
Yeah, good question. So, I mean, you want to look at sleep patterns, is there an increase of sleep, decrease of sleep, food intake, are they eating more or less, their engagement in activities. So you wanted to be able to monitor, when I talk about changes in behaviors, it's just changes in their day-to-day routine. Anything that you notice that might be not typical for their daily routine.
You mentioned earlier that you're not advocating that people become those helicopter parents that, you know, won't give the kid room to breathe. But isn't there another problem that parents are very often the last to notice this stuff?
Yeah, and you're right. Sometimes the parents are last to notice. The kids are spending majority of their time at school. They're 8 hours a day with their teachers or their aftercare and the activities that they're engaging in. Parents are also, there's a lot of expectations and financials. So they're at work, they're, you know, whatever's going on in the family. So they might not be the first one to recognize it, which is why everyone in the community, the teachers, whoever it is, their coaches, should be educated on this as well.
What, with regard to something like screening, let's talk about this on a professional level. You've done this. There's been a problem. Let's say it's been a substance abuse problem or a discipline problem or school or aggression or anger, and now they're in front of you. What are you looking to find out from that initial screening? What are you looking for?
It depends on what the client is coming in with. What I'm looking for is, I want to meet with the parents and see what they're initially bringing in. Because when I'm working with adolescents and, you know, teenagers, the kids are not saying, hey, I want to go see a therapist. So I'm initially meeting with the family to see why, what's going on, what are they noticing, and then I'm going to meet with the child separately and get their perception. Perception is very different. Kids look up to their parents as role models, so they might not necessarily share with them what they would share with me. So I'm going to meet the kids where they are. Of course, number one, I'm going to assess for safety in the home, in the school, and in the community, because everything is going to build off of that. But I want to understand, I want to meet the child where they are. Mm-hmm. And typically, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Just meeting the child where they are. And typically, what they're coming in and sharing is a little bit different than the way it's being presented by the parents.
Oh, sure.
So then my job is really to strengthen that relationship, establish a rapport with the client, and then encourage them to be able to communicate that with mom and dad or whoever the caregiver is. Because I could ultimately do that, but that's not changing anything for the future. The goal is to have the child be able to communicate this going forward, since therapy might be temporary.
Yeah. Liza, let me ask you, with regard to dealing with both the parent and the adolescent or the young adult, do you find that parents have an expectation that a clinician or a therapist like you should be on their side? Do you know what I mean? And that puts you in a tough spot. You have to gain the trust of the young person or nothing's going to happen, correct?
Yes. And you also have to gain the trust of the parent as well, that you have the family's best interest. And usually if the family is bringing their child in, they're willing. In a private, I'm talking about in a private practice
right.
setting,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily a community mental health setting. But if a parent is bringing their child to you, it's because they want to see, they want to know, they want to get involved, they care, they recognize that something's not right. So it's a sometimes a little bit easier to get them on board, but oftentimes we're making referrals for the parents as well or the caregivers to participate in therapy themselves, because they bring in the identified client and it's, hey, fix my child. She's depressed. She's anxious. She's being bullied. But it's a whole family dynamic, mm-hmm. and everybody has to be on board in order for any change to be elicited.
Do, in your experience as a therapist, do most parents understand that you have a unique relationship with their child and you have to sort of honor that, even though obviously you wouldn't withhold anything from them, but you have a different relationship with the adolescent than you would with the adult, right?
Of course, yes. And the parents are reassured. And if there's any reason for me to believe that the child is in danger or any behaviors that they're displaying could lead to, you know, something, I am a mandated reporter. As a licensed mental health counselor, we are mandated reporters. So I want to make sure that I have that, develop that relationship so that the child feels comfortable that she can share, he or she can share things with me, but the parent also knows if there's anything that I need to communicate to them about, we absolutely will. And I really, it's mandated that the family participate. So whether it's every other week that they're coming in or a 5-minute follow-up phone call, it's not just a 50-minute, you meet with my child and things are going to change. The 50 minutes is part of the process, but the week that they're not in therapy, that's when the therapy happens.
I understand. I know this is a tough question to answer in a minute or two, because not all disorders are treated the same way. But are there a couple of techniques or treatment methods that you found are particularly helpful with young people?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely depends on, again, presentation, but really just providing a safe place. That is the most effective tool for teenagers, for children, is allowing them an opportunity to express their feelings and maybe engaging in reflective and active listening. Of course, cognitive behavioral therapy is a highly utilized tool. But unless they feel comfortable, unless there's a safe place for them to engage and express emotions, none of the other stuff matters.
Liza Barkarski is our guest. We have more with Liza straight ahead. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We have been speaking to Liza Pikarski. Liza's a licensed mental health counselor. She's with Retreat in their West Palm Beach facility. She's 15 years in the field now, treating young adults and adolescents who suffer from one or both of substance abuse issues and mental health disorders. We really have had Liza with us today to give us a broad overview of the sort of state of the mental health of the young people today. The news is not good. We said at the beginning that estimates range as high as 1 in 5 young people suffering from some sort of a mental health disorder, and the number is growing. So we appreciate Liza's time with us. Liza, let's take a few minutes here at the end and talk about the difference between the sort of things that affect young women and the sort of things that are affecting young men. Let's start, because they're not, they don't suffer from the same sort of problems. Tell us about the girls first. What are they looking at?
Self-esteem. You know, when we really look at a lot of them, males and females might be looking at similar things. It's just not showing up the same way. So where there might be self-esteem with females more so, it's still happening with males. Same thing, eating disorders, depression. So I don't want to limit and say it's females versus males in terms of what the symptoms are. I think that goes back, that might go back to, the stigma around not sharing it and girls being more open to communicate some of these feelings, which lead to, you know, the diagnosis of depression or low self-esteem concerns.
One of the most distinctive differences we see when it comes to behavioral problems between young women and young men is in the area of violence. I mentioned earlier that as a clinician, you were brought in very early on after the shooting at in Parkland that took I think 17 lives. We all know about the shooting down there. So, is there a simple answer for why it's young men who erupt in these murderous rages? Is it just hormones? What is it?
Yeah, males tend to, I don't have the exact answer, but from what I see is, you know, males tend to internalize. They don't express their emotions. From a young age, we hear, be a man about it. You know, there's things in society that we utilize. We don't realize how it can impact our younger generation. Be a man about it. Man up. Boys don't cry. You know, you think of all these sayings that happen and how often they're utilized. Well, that can absolutely contribute to males internalizing and not feeling comfortable expressing. Therefore, it tends to come out in more aggressive patterns of behaviors. Whereas females are more able to communicate their thoughts and feelings, and then, you know, they engage in self-harm, but they're expressing it. So I think that's a big factor.
Yeah, girls hurt themselves, boys hurt other people. It's amazing. It is amazing. Tell us how you got involved with the school in Parkland after the shooting down there. You were grief counseling? Is that what happened?
Not necessarily grief counseling, but I was asked by the school board EAP to come in due to the relationship that I had with them to do run weekly support groups for actually the staff rather than the children. So that was my role. I think every counselor in Broward County and Palm Beach County, the day it happened, the day after, was willing to do anything and everything that it took to be there and support and work through the community during the tragedy. I took on the role of running the support group, where I really just served for the teachers as a safe place to come in and share thoughts and feelings and really identify ways to cope and work through the loss and some trauma so that they can return and be effective teachers and be effective leaders in school, because a lot of everybody in the community, not everybody, a lot of people were tending to the children. Of course, they needed the help, but there really wasn't as much effort initially for the teachers. So I think the school board did a great job of trying to implement something where they can have a safe place as well. Because they were putting on, they had to put on a strong face every
sure.
day getting into school after that tragedy.
Liza, thanks so much for your time. I know that you are passionate about helping these young people. I'm going to give you the standard radio one wish. If you could wave a wand and make something happen that you think would help young people regarding their mental health, what would it be?
Early intervention. Every year, a child is expected to get a physical prior to entering in the school year. That physical should come with a mental health screening every single year, doing mental health assessment. It will normalize the access to mental health services. Therefore, it would decrease the stigma. So that would be my one wish if I had it.
Yeah, I would suspect that school boards might be on board with something like that. I wonder whether parents would worry about the stigma of this. What do you mean you want a mental screening of my kid? There's nothing wrong with my kid. How do you overcome that?
Yeah, I think you're definitely going to have to address those problems as they arise. But the reality is, in the last, I was looking at numbers of school shootings, and we're at 98 right now. From 2014 to right now, there's 98. And if we were able to implement that in the schools, and we can get the point across to parents that this might reduce that number, this might keep your kid, not necessarily safe because there's other factors involved, that this could be an opportunity to get the child help at an early stage.
Yeah.
I think that they might be open to it.
No, I agree with you, Liza. I couldn't agree with you more. It's just a tragedy, and it doesn't seem to ever end. Liza Piekarski, thanks so much for joining us. We're going to have you back again. This is a bigger topic than we can get done in one short period of time. Thanks so much, though.
Thank you.
Take care, guys, and keep looking for Recovery Radio wherever podcasts are available. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.